introduced, and welcome Jessica Cook, who is visiting us from Arizona State University. Jessica did her PhD with Lorenzo Serva at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She finished her PhD in 2013, and then since then has been a postdoc at Arizona State University at, what's the name of the institute? I forgot that. Or there's a name. Is that Origin?
Oh, yeah, Origin.
Origin Institute, yes, Origin Institute. And she's going to tell us today about reducing predictions in single field inflection. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, so reheating predictions in single field inflation, but more specifically how we can use assumptions about reheating, wanting reheating to fall to be reasonable.
We also have like a trademark
okay.
pointer for Canadians. Yeah.
Okay.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
I can probably find a laser pointer as well, but this is more authentic.
Okay. How to use reheating, assumptions about reheating to constrain inflation. So frequently, when one talks about reheating, one starts by writing down couplings between the inflaton and whatever it's going to decay into, and then from the coupling constants, you can get decay rates. This is difficult for two reasons. Number one, we don't know exactly what fields the inflaton is going to couple to, though we do know, presumably eventually, it decays into radiation if it's followed by radiation-dominated phase. And we don't know how strongly it couples to other fields. So there's a lot of free parameters that we don't understand. And number two, solving, especially during preheating, is extremely difficult because you're in a non-perturbative regime, thermal effects are relevant, and the calculations are very difficult, and you can do them numerically, and people have done them numerically, but it's nice to have, for certain cases, but it's nice to have a simple analytic way of at least characterizing the parameter space without worrying about details that might or might not be true and doing things in a pretty general way. So instead of supposing couplings of the inflaton to other fields, we can ignore all these microphysical details and instead frame everything in terms of an average equation to state parameter, which I'm going to call W sub RE for reheating. And so this equation to state parameter is going to depend both on what is the equation to state of the inflaton during reheating. Normally it's assumed it's behaving like matter, maybe not. And then what is the equation of state of whatever the inflaton is decaying into? So this gives a simple way of characterizing reheating while remaining fairly general. We can look at different cases of different equations of state during reheating. And then we can require the equation of state during reheating to lie within certain reasonable bounds. For example, the most general case, we can say the equation of state needs to lie between negative a third and one. So the idea is if the equation of state during reheating were less than negative one third, then you would still be inflating. So assuming reheating started, it has to be greater than negative one third. And then it's natural to also assume that it's going to be less than one, assuming you don't want the inflaton or whatever it's decaying into to be tachyonic. This gives a safe set of bounds on the equation of state, which then can be used to work backwards and put broad bounds on inflation parameters like NS and AS, such that you get a reheating scenario for that model that falls within this range. You could also be more specific and say, let's say we think the equation of state, it's likely that it falls within the range 0 to 1 third, somewhere between matter and radiation. And then this gives you a more narrow prediction for what you want to occur during reheating, and then it gives you a more narrow range of bounds when you work back and figure out the range of inflation parameters that can be consistent with this. So normally when one wants to check whether a particular model of inflation, you have a potential in mind that you've picked, and you want to test whether or not it's consistent with Planck bounds, you can first see, take the first and second derivative, see if there is a spot on that potential that can give you the right NS value. And once you do, you can see if the height can be adjusted to give you the right AS, the right amplitude of the power spectrum at that same point. This isn't enough, though. Depending how far this point is from when inflation ends during that model, it might be inconsistent with having a reasonable reheating model following. So for example, normally this is taken into account. One can just check, oh, I get the right NS and AS for this potential at a specific point. How long does inflation last from when that point exits the horizon to when inflation ends? And normally, if you get that the range or the length of inflation is between 50 or 60 e-folds, then you get that that a reasonable reheating scenario is consistent. But that's not, that works pretty well for most models, but of course, it's actually model dependent. Not all models will be consistent with the 50 to 60 bound. Some of them are going to be a little different. And then of course, it also depends, what range you get depends on what type of assumptions you want to make about reheating. So this 50 to 60 number is going to change slightly depending on, do you want an equation of state during reheating that corresponds to somewhere in the range of negative 1/3 to 1, or do you want to make different assumptions? For example, sort of the simplest of reheating cases, if you ignore preheating and you just assume that your inflaton is behaving like matter during reheating and it's decaying very slowly, gradually, then you often get that the equation of state is a little greater, the average equation of state is a little greater than zero. And so in this case, if that's what you think happens, you get a more narrow range on what you think this equation of state parameter during reheating is, and then that will reflect back and give you a more narrow range on inflation parameters. Similarly, if you instead think that an efficient preheating phase took place, most couplings you write down for the inflaton allow for a preheating phase. If you believe that a preheating was efficient, the inflaton decayed very quickly, rapidly initially, then often you get that the equation of state jumps up close to 1/3 very quickly and then maybe takes a much longer time. Yeah.
Sorry,
no, oh, okay. to increase the rest of the way to 1/3. So then the average ends up becoming close to 1/3. And this, again, if you think this is what happens, this gives you a more narrow set of parameters that you can then test. That will give you more narrow ranges on NS, AS, whatever, for your inflation model. And one of the reasons this is so important to try to be as precise as we can in our predictions for different inflation models is if we want to be able to eventually tell them apart and figure out which inflation model is correct. Of course, if BICEP eventually, or Keck, one of these experiments eventually ends up detecting actual primordial B modes, this will give us a lot of information about how inflation happened. But if that doesn't happen, then the amount of data we have from the CMB isn't going to help that much more in the future. There's more we can do. Temperature data is already at the cosmic variance limit. We could do more. There's more data available in E-modes. If eventually there might be another CMB satellite that focuses on polarization, or there's more that can be done with looking at smaller wavelength modes with large scale structures. So there is more data out there that should help narrow the predictions better, but even with all this data, the parameters aren't likely to change dramatically from where they are right now, the constraints. And so we need to make the most of all the data available and be as precise as we can with inflation models if we want to distinguish them and figure out which one's correct. So the way you can actually relate constraints of reheating to inflation parameters, if you know what the equation of state is as a function of time during reheating, right, this will tell us how the energy density during reheating is changing with time. So if we take the conservation of energy equation, then we can get an integral for how the energy density of reheating is changing as a function of time using E-folding as the time variable, integrating over the equation of state. But what ends up happening is, if you notice in this term, if you just plug out a 1 over the total change of time, this last term just becomes the average equation of state. So it ends up that you really only need to worry about the average equation of state and the total length of reheating if you want to relate the energy density at the beginning and end of reheating. And if you have a particular model of inflation in mind, you can figure out where does epsilon equal 1, where does inflation end for that model? That will tell you what the energy density is at the start of reheating, and then using the equation of state and the length of reheating, you can come up with the energy density, what I'm calling rho RE, at the end of reheating. And then from there, you can, if you know the number of relativistic degrees of freedom at the end of reheating, then you can relate the density to a temperature. And we just used 100, assuming like normal standard model, but if you change the number of relativistic degrees of freedom, even if you multiply them by like a factor of 2, assuming like SUSY, it ends up only depending logarithmically on that number, so it doesn't end up changing things that much. And so there's another constraint, another piece of information that needs to be used to relate reheating to inflation. And that is basically the solution to the horizon problem. So the idea is we know that the like L equals 2 modes that we see on the CMB, the longest wavelength modes, correspond to the size of the horizon today. So we can calculate for a given model how many co-moving scales exit the horizon for that model before inflation ends. So that basically, if we're plotting here the logarithm of 1 over the co-moving scales, the length of this line depends on the model of inflation. The slope is just what you get assuming the equation of state is -1 during inflation, but the length of the line will change depending on how long how many co-moving scales exit the horizon during inflation. And then we know that however many modes exit from L equals 2 to the end of inflation, that same number of co-moving scales better re-enter the horizon after inflation. And so you can force that equality. That gives us the second constraint. So we know how many co-moving scales, we know this line, how many co-moving scales re-enter the horizon during matter domination, because we know how much the horizon expanded during that period. What we don't know is how long did the radiation-dominated phase last and how long did reheating last. But we can relate them because depending on what the equation of state was during reheating determines how efficiently modes are able to re-enter the horizon during reheating. So if you have a really large equation of state during reheating, modes enter super efficiently. And then you can compensate with a shorter radiation-dominated phase. If, on the other hand, the equation of state during reheating was quite low, then modes enter very inefficiently. This is sort of the limiting case of -1/3 no modes. The co-moving horizon doesn't change at all. And then you have to compensate with a much longer radiation-dominated phase. But just requiring that the number of scales that exit the horizon from L equals 2 to the end of inflation re-enter the horizon is the second constraint you need. And then putting that together with the relations on the change in energy density, you can calculate the length of reheating in E-folds and the temperature of reheating at the end of reheating, just in terms of the average equation of state during reheating and parameters that just depend on your inflation model at inflation scales. So the potential at the end of the end of inflation, the Hubble parameter at the pivot scale, and so if you're matching onto data, right? Planck has a specific pivot scale that corresponds to like L equals 600 something, or it's wherever you're measuring your data, your CMB data at.
But I thought you Don't you care about the horizon size that L equals to 2?
You can do it either way.
I think it doesn't matter.
Right, I think picture-wise, it's easier to picture like, oh, this is the whole horizon size today, that's why I was saying L equals 2. But when you're matching onto data, you really just pick the pivot scale, whatever experiment.
But even just the biggest scales to have re-entered the horizon, so those are the ones that could be the strictest bound, I guess.
Right, but then you could just like count, like, take it into account and say, oh, well, like 5 e-folds or whatever corresponds from L equals 2 to Planck's pivot, so, and you can just take that into account. And then basically the length of inflation, the number of e-folds that exit the horizon from the pivot scale to the end of inflation. So you can just take parameters that depend on your inflation model for a given equation of state. You can then calculate the length of reheating and the temperature at the end. If the equation of state during reheating, the average equation of state, was very close to 1/3, then actually things simplify much more. And you, for a given inflation model, you get a very precise prediction of NS. Instead of a range of NS values, you get a prediction for one NS value that solves that equation. In practice, the average equation of state probably won't be exactly 1/3. It would probably be slightly less. So you will get a range, but a very, very narrow range in that case.
Can I see, like, by looking at the top equation, if I take the limit of W going to 1/3, I get the bottom.
No, I mean, I think that, it's like the step before you get this equation, you get.
And I see, I can multiply by 1 minus 3W, right, I guess that would, so you're saying that the numerator should vanish, which is the equation you have, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Good.
And you're hoping it vanishes at the same rate.
What is it?
You're hoping it vanishes at the same rate.
Yeah, exactly. But I think what happens at W of 1/3 is that reheating is indistinguishable from radiation era. So,
exactly.
And reheating is not well defined. It could be anything.
Right. But you do get a really nice prediction for your inflation parameters, which could be useful, yeah. So in practice, using these equations, we can then apply them to models of inflation and see how well do they fit on with Planck data. So for example, if we want to take the polynomial type inflation models, so phi to some power, and then we can look at different powers and apply these equations and figure out, okay, what's the temperature and the length of reheating, and do the models we like correspond to ranges of NS that are compatible with Planck? So the different colored lines correspond to different equations of state during reheating. So trying to do some of the most important cases, an equation of state of negative 1/3 and 1, so almost certainly any solution is going to be between the red and the black lines, but I would propose probably a solution is going to be within the green and the blue lines corresponding to matter and radiation. For example, so if we look at like the phi squared case, showing on this axis the temperature at the end of reheating and the length of reheating as a function of NS, we can look, are there solutions between the green and the blue curves that correspond, that overlap in predictions for NS with Planck data, where the pink bars are the 1 sigma bounds from Planck. And for the phi to the fourth case, I zoomed out and showed both the 1 and 2 sigma bounds, since that one doesn't work so well. And the dark green band down here shows the bound from BBN. So the temperature has to be above this dark green band. And I'm not sure if you can see, but there's also a light green band around 100 to represent approximation of when electroweak symmetry breaking probably occurred. So if you believe in electroweak baryogenesis, then you further want to be above a temperature of 100. And so this gives you a direct way of checking models and seeing what range of NS are consistent with those models by requiring reasonable bounds on reheating. So one of the cases that I think is really interesting is this case where if you believe in very efficient preheating, and it's been shown in some examples that if you believe that an efficient preheating phase happened and the equation of state rose very quickly close to 1/3 and then took a longer time to increase the rest of the way to 1/3, then you get an average equation of state that's very close to radiation. This corresponds to showing just for the phi squared case, this corresponds to a very narrow prediction for NS. So if you believe in efficient preheating, then this gives you very specific, more narrow bounds on the NS predicted by different inflation models, which makes them much more distinct from one another. So a lot of the work using these equations in the past has focused on the equation of state during reheating around zero. So the idea being that the inflaton, assuming that it behaves like matter during reheating, and the simplest cases you write down, usually ignoring preheating, you often get an average equation of state close to zero, a little bit bigger than zero. And then, so using these equations, you can then say for that equation of state, what's the range of temperatures consistent with Planck's range on NS values? So this can be useful, but it tends to be most of the models that work well that have a lot of overlap with Planck's predictions for NS also incorporate pretty much the entire temperature range from BBN to instantaneous reheating, the maximum reheating temperature. I think one of the cases where this is really useful is if you have assumptions about reheating like efficient preheating or very inefficient cases where you can look at a more narrow case and then it becomes easier to distinguish inflation models from one another.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
You say you get precise predictions on NS. If you change the radiation dominant history to have a different degrees of freedom thing, so say that you have Suze degrees of freedom at some scale, but you don't have that, how much would that change your NS prediction for a given inflation model?
I mean, I guess it depends on how much that's changing the equation of state. I guess if you're
But let's say you doubled the number of vector relativistic degrees of freedom that scales above some tens of TeV or something. How much would that change your writing?
If it didn't change the equation of state, it would have almost no effect at all. If you're adding new decay channels that allow reheating to progress much more quickly, then that could have an effect because now your equation of state is growing.
But there is some logarithmic dependence on the number of degrees of freedom, which you mentioned.
Right.
Yes. I mean, yeah, so if you have some uncertainty on that, that's the question.
Yes, keeping the equation of state fixed, changing the number of relativistic degrees of freedom has a very small effect. It changes, doubling them changes NRE by maybe like 2 E foldings. It's quite small because it only appears logarithmically in the equations.
So in terms of predictions for NS that you were saying,
uh-huh.
Would that hold that?
Yeah, very minimal. I don't know exactly, maybe 0.01 or something. It's quite small unless you're saying, oh, well, now it's decaying much more efficiently.
Yeah, sure.
And
it's
so,
just about the
right, okay. So another way to show the same information that I think is useful is you can make like an NS versus R plot or a length of inflation versus NS plot and show the whole parameter space for your model. So for example, for phi squared inflation, so it's m squared, phi squared, right? Different points on the line are going to correspond to different masses. And they will also correspond to different predictions. And you can color code the whole parameter space to see, well, what reheating scenarios are consistent with that parameter space. So showing the green band represents an equation of state greater than 1, so unless your inflaton or whatever it's decaying into is tachyonic, that's almost certainly not going to be correct. The orange is for an equation of state less than zero. The yellow would be an equation of state greater than 1/3. And the red would correspond to an equation of state less than 1/3. And so in particular, if you believe in a solution where the average equation of state is between matter and radiation, then this red band, the solution would have to fall in this narrow red band. And so then this gives you predictions for NS and R or whatever parameters you like for that model. And then you can compare then for like phi squared inflation for to have a solution between 0 and 1/3 would require R greater than or equal to 0.14, which is highly unlikely at this point. If we relax the restriction, just require a solution with an equation of state less than 1, but anywhere less than 1, then the bound comes down to 0.11, but it's still looking pretty unlikely. So then we considered the Starobinsky model. So the idea being you have the normal Einstein-Hilbert term plus you add this extra R squared term, which can generate inflation. And the easiest way to calculate predictions for this model is to transform the metric in such a way that you get out normal Einstein-Hilbert again, plus a new field, which when canonically normalized, has this potential. And then another case which has almost the same predictions at inflation scales is Higgs inflation. So we can end up putting these two results together. So the idea behind Higgs inflation, of course, we know that the Higgs exists. It is a scalar. It could be the inflaton, but only if you have a large non-minimal coupling to gravity. But if you allow for that, then you can again transform the metric in such a way that when the Higgs is canonically normalized, you get out the exact same potential at high scales, at high field values for the Higgs as you get in the Starobinsky case. So
can I ask?
Yeah.
So I mean, this potential, if I just expand it around zero, then it wouldn't be consistent with the standard model Higgs, or what happens to it?
Okay, so to get this potential out, you have to assume that the VEV of the Higgs is very large, because there's a whole bunch of approximations that you have to take before it comes down to this.
So this is not good around like the standard model minimum.
No. This was completely the wrong potential. Yeah, there. Okay, so the Starobinsky and the Higgs models look very different at small field values, but in the equations shown before to calculate the length of reheating and the temperature at the end of reheating, all you need is the equation of state and the values of parameters at inflation scales. And since the two models look the same in the high field limits, the bounds that you get from requiring these assumptions about the equation of state during reheating look the same for both models. But that isn't to say that the models are most likely to have similar predictions for reheating. Probably reheating would look very different in both models, and so the most likely equation of state for each model is different, but the parameter space just using these equations looks the same. And so it comes out like this. So again, plotting the same way, you get different possibilities depending on the value of the non-minimal coupling. But we can color code these regions to correspond to different reheating equation of state values. And so if we just look at this red band, if we want a solution with the equation of state during reheating between matter and radiation, then we get these predictions for NS and R, and they're perfectly consistent so far with Planck data. The next model we considered was hilltop models. So they have a potential of this form where we allowed for different values of this exponent. And so depending on if that exponent is odd or even, you get potentials that look like this. In this case, now there's two free parameters, this M out front and the mu. So when we allow these two free parameters to vary for the different scenarios, instead of getting a line of predictions in the NS versus R plane, you get an area drawn out. And then you can check again if that area, how well it fits with Planck data. And for all three cases that we considered, for the different exponents, it fits pretty well.
So for all these, for the R versus NS, could you just remind me where roughly the ellipses are for the constraints, just to get a sense of, like, from Planck?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to show that at the very end. I'm going to show, like, everything together with that. Great. Yeah. And then the last model we considered was natural inflation. So again, in this case, you end up with two free parameters. You have this amplitude out front and this other parameter, F. And so again, you get an area drawn out in these cases. This case, as I'll show in the next slide, tends to favor smaller NS, but there's still some overlap with Planck's range.
So if I actually fix W repeating, does that fix the line there, or that's
still
a range?
Wait, say that again.
If
sorry.
I fix W.
If you fix W.
W repeating, yeah.
Oh, yeah, then you would get, yeah, then I think you would get a line. Like this bound, like this line right here between the red and the yellow would correspond to equation of state of a third. Then we can put everything together, take the different models, and using the constraints on reheating to draw out the allowed spaces for these models and compare with data. So I'm showing in this model, average equation of state during reheating between zero and a third, and that ends up giving you very similar results of what you do when you require the length of inflation be between 50 and 60 e-folds. It's slightly different. For example, the natural inflation looks like it's moving slightly away from the central region. It's pretty similar, though. But you do a little better. The idea is you're now doing things in a model-dependent way. I would propose this is slightly better, a little bit more precise.
Dependent or independent?
Well, the prediction, instead of saying like the 50 to 60 range, that range that's preferred is different for each model. The other thing that makes this useful is, again, if you prefer efficient preheating, you think that average equation of state is closer to one third, then instead of this whole range, you would have, for example, in the purple, you would have like a narrow band right along the bottom as your prediction. So it gives you a framework from which you can vary your assumptions about reheating and see how that changes the fits with Planck data. And depending on your assumptions, it can give you more precise predictions that distinguish the models a little better. Okay, and that's it.
Thank you very much. And I should mention that Jessica is going to be here, I think, tomorrow afternoon. So, and her office is the second floor. I don't know what number.
267.
I'm going to find her before she leaves tomorrow. Good. Questions for Jessica?
What data is on the horizon to put further constraints? Or so far, you've been using Planck.
Yeah.
What else is coming in front? So it's not my fault. So what future data will you be part of constraint?
Oh, so Okay, so like the constraint on the 1 and 2 sigma bounds.
Sure.
Yeah, well, I would think better polarization data, if we get the emodes better, then that will squeeze things a little bit better. Lowering things in this direction would be, you know, plank and bicep for gradually lowering this. I should say this is from using Planck's results. These bounds are now a little bit lower thanks to the new result from Keck. And then large scale structure data should help too in the future. Yeah, but just using better EMOs and large scale structure, I don't think these blobs are going to change that dramatically.
So I guess the number of equivalent between 50 and 60, so you're saying that's not really the right number. So what is,
well,
what is
it works quite well, right? You can see like it doesn't change that much. So it works quite well, but I think, yeah, you can do slightly better because the 50 to 60 works in general. It's going to be a little different. Every model is going to be a little different. And then especially if you don't want to use 0 to 1/3, if you think like your assumptions of reheating correspond to the equation of state being different, then that of course will.
So did you include, you haven't included the Keck,
no.
The new bicep Keck Planck polarization. Okay. So that's going to bring things
right,
farther
right.
down a little bit, I see.
Yeah.
So what's the new purple crescent bit?
The
big purple swatch.
This is natural inflation.
Okay.
Particle, is that the green
one?
Is the particle?
Yeah, this blob here. So this is the potential is some constant times 1 minus pi to the 4th.
Yeah. So do you have a sense of, I mean, whether if we say that the inflaton is Higgs, that kind of, since we have some idea about how Higgs couples to Stammel particles, we can say something about reheating?
Yeah, that's, yes, certainly people have done that. That's a very different approach, but you can, knowing the Higgs couplings, you can get more precise predictions. And I think in practice, that's really good, and just say, oh, well, the equation
is
probably turns out to be this.
But is the answer, is there a consensus, any idea about what is the consequence that if inflaton is Higgs and it's decaying to Stammel particles, then say, what would be the W reheating?
I'm not sure.
Imagine it would be, even if you know the coupling, it would be a complicated thing to count. Yeah, would there be a preheating for Higgs inflation or not?
I think there is. I think generally for most couplings you write down, you get at least some period of preheating.
Good. There is no more questions? Thank Jessica one more time.